Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined this week by our special guest, Nick Barnett, who is a contractor and consultant and also one of our fabulous judges for this year's The Wires. Nick, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad, sir. And rounding out the ExchangeWire contingent and also the Australian contingent, it's ExchangeWire COO, Rachel Smith. Rachel, how's you?
Hello. I think I'm the only Australian on this call. Nick might live in Australia and have a quasi-Australian accent, but I think he's a Brit.
I am. I sure am. My hybrid accent's not fooling anyone.
Not here.
No further discussion about Vegemite and Tim Tams necessary then.
Oh, why not?
All the cricket.
As long as you don't mention penguins, it's all fine.
Awesome. I'll make sure to strike that one out in the notes. Kicking into the first news story of the week, TikTok has launched a new first-party data solution innovatively called Lead Generation. This works by giving users a form which they can use to provide their personal details, such as their name and phone number, in order to indicate their interest in a specific product or service they see within a video. Companies can then use this information to create tailored communications for their target segments and also integrate these leads into their own CRM. In the standard press spiel, TikTok were keen to emphasize that lead generation respects the sanctity of user privacy, with their data made only available to the relevant advertisers. And users are also presented with a host of privacy notices because we don't have enough of those already. Keen to get your guys' first impressions of this one. And also, you know, of the new solution, do you think it will attract more advertisers towards TikTok? Rachel, let's start off with you.
So to answer that last question first, do I think it's going to attract more advertisers to TikTok? I think it's certainly going to be seen as a useful tool for advertisers because they're understandably keenly focused on getting user consent, and you know, this is a good way to do that. Lead gen's really important for them, not just the trade name of the tool, but the concept of lead generation is obviously really important for them. Will it attract more advertisers to the platform? I definitely think it's going to be interesting for advertisers because they understandably are really focused on lead gen. My feelings though are this will really be about execution, the quality of execution, right? Because if I'm a user on TikTok and I'm asked whether I'm prepared to give over my name and email address and telephone number, I'm going to say no, especially when it comes to my phone number. But then again, I'm not your average TikTok user, although I might be these days because, you know, the audience is widening. But I personally am not a TikTok user. I probably will be in another month or two's time. But and maybe I'm also not the target audience for a lot of brands that are advertising on TikTok. And maybe we're talking, you know, maybe when we're looking at a classic TikTok audience, younger generation, maybe they're not so bothered about sharing their data if they feel like there is a value exchange. And that's the other thing I would be thinking is, what will I be getting in return for this? And I noticed that those sorts of sharing your data incentives work very well when people see a clear value exchange. I know from a privacy point of view, certainly in Europe, both in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, as far as GDPR legislation is concerned, you're not allowed to directly incentivize people to share their data. So I can understand there might not be a direct, monetizable sort of incentive, but I really think it'll be all about the execution as to whether users will actually tolerate it. I think advertisers are going to love it. I'm just not sure about users.
Absolutely. To me, it seems very clunky. Like, you know, TikTok user, I would imagine they're used to expecting, right, I've seen this product, click through, there's the product straight away, I can buy it. Rather than having to fill out a form with the prompt, you know, potential that company may contact them back, it just seems a very almost old school method. Nick, what are your thoughts on that one?
Well, I actually remember when Facebook first did this with their lead gen campaigns, and I was working in one of the major banks at the time, and it almost opened up the door to some of the sort of more legacy thinkers or old school thinkers who want a direct return for their marketing spend. And the thing about lead gen is they could all of a sudden go from these brand campaigns where they couldn't directly measure what the impact was to all of a sudden they could see these home loan leads coming through. And it's like, what do you mean I can use social media to directly generate home loans leads? So I think it's a great move from TikTok. They're also doing a great time because Facebook is heading into a lot of sort of regulator woes at the moment, some industry headwinds, particularly around IDFA and what's happening with Apple devices. And the fact that these changes to privacy at a device and browser level are really going to hurt them. It's going to cost them a lot of money. And so TikTok is actually leaning to this. They're offering this, you know, directly within their platform. So it also means that they don't have things like an audience network that will be affected by IDFA as well. I think, you know, in terms of an advertiser, people are looking for something fresh. Facebook has become probably a little bit like me, really tired looking, you know, starting to stumble a little bit and just generally probably needs that, you know, these advertisers are looking for something fresher, something that's cool. The thing is that they've got a growing active user base. Their growth is likely to continue for some time, particularly in some of the younger age groups and the younger demographics. They are seeing that they're addressing a lot of the trust concerns as well. So now, coupled with that, I think we're going to see a lot of people moving their money into this and probably looking at broader activities with TikTok off the back of it. Add in as well that there's a lot more local representation. There's the local offices opening up, which is just going to make it easier to build relationships with the advertisers. And a lot more brands are now saying, hey, I don't have this performance focus from my cookie bombing and, you know, all the third-party data that's suddenly disappearing and going to have disappeared, over the next couple of years. I need to start doing more brand building and influencer-based activities. Well, here we have lead gen and a bunch more stuff that you can do with TikTok. Thing I'd be watching out for, I think Rachel hit the nail on the head, is that GDPR has really set the tone for how these kinds of businesses are regulated. And as we can see with Facebook and Google, regulators and law and legal woes are what will really come back in the long term and put pressures on your operating margins. And so it's very important that they establish their role as either a controller, a joint controller, or a processor. Who owns the data that is being captured? Where's it being stored? If someone wants that data to be deleted, who's going to ensure that the distribution, right from when that person filled in that form through to where it's being used in campaigns, that data can be deleted? There's a lot that's going to go into the governance. And I'd probably say as well, there's a lot of brands, especially the big institutions, that will be looking at some of the concerns that have arisen from things like nudity and the content that's in the platform and the brand safety association with some of the campaigns they're running. But overall, definitely thumbs up.
I think that's a really interesting point, how TikTok are going to firstly decide what their responsibilities are or have someone else decide for them, determine what their responsibilities are with respect to data control and managing and handling that data. But I think furthermore, that's the thing that makes me a little wary of the degree to which users will adopt this or will willingly, you know, hand over their data. So I've got two sort of schools of thought here. And one is that it might work really well, actually, for some users, because there are users and also I think younger generation are maybe a little more inclined to think this way too, where they're quite happy to develop a bit more of a personal, closer relationship with the brands that they're purchasing things from. They want to know something about that brand. They want to understand perhaps their environmental sustainability credentials. They want to know what type of a company they are, what kind of ethos they've got, what kind of social purpose they might have. So I can imagine if those sorts of brands are advertising in that TikTok environment and asking for people's personal data by way of expressing their interest in these products, that there might be people that would be willing to hand that over because they want to know more about those products and about that brand. And then it comes down to how the brand handles all of that. And that is the really important bit associated with what you just said there, Nick, because is the brand in control of that data or is TikTok in control of their data? And ultimately the test will be whether you wind up getting a spam phone call, because as soon as that happens, that's when you think, ah, this is because I gave my phone number over to TikTok the other day in exchange for, you know, viewing ads or whatever. And now I'm not going to do that. And then that makes you negatively associate the brand with what's just happened and form negative opinions about TikTok as a platform, right? So if the brands can control that sort of exchange and environment, then it could work really well. Then there's going to be others my age and beyond who will just go, no way, not giving my phone number to anyone because we're deeply suspicious of everyone that asks for our phone number. But you're from an advertising point of view and from a sort of operational point of view, you're 100% right about why this is a good move from TikTok. It totally makes perfect sense. I'm just really interested to see the execution.
Also, one sort of last sort of question I wanted to ask you guys on this one. Does if this platform does go successfully, will it prove mobile as more of a key channel for businesses, or is it still kind of a bit more balanced between display and mobile?
I mean, I think mobile has to be a key channel for advertisers. And yes, I think absolutely it will just continue to highlight the importance of advertising in a mobile environment, because that's exactly how platforms like TikTok have got their popularity in the first instance. And, you know, with Nick helpfully drawing some comparisons between the early days of Facebook, it just reminds me how those early days for Facebook existed in so many different environments, very much a desktop environment to start with, and then, you know, expanding much more into mobile environments. But this is an entirely new world and a new generation. And also we're talking about a platform that's got an immense user base in countries where mobile is the only device that people are using to connect to the internet. So my opinion on that is absolutely, it will highlight the importance of mobile being a critical channel for advertisers.
Definitely. I also agree. And I think the key thing I'd point out here is that it will highlight that mobile is a key channel for the right reasons, because what's happened in the past is a lot of probably advertisers, but also agencies, publishers, a lot of marketing teams around the world have potentially misinterpreted the performance data that has been used to understand, is this the right channel to be working in? And the problem with that is it given rise to tactics like cookie bombing, which of course is where you use all the third-party data from across the internet to find someone who's going to look at a pair of shoes who just happens to be browsing, and then you follow them everywhere around the internet that they go from that moment onwards until they buy your pair of shoes. And for me, that's wrong, and that's why this is such an important time that we're going through with the global advertising cleanup. So really, I think what's going to happen now is you've got platforms like TikTok, as you mentioned, that contextually are really important to certain demographics. Me also not included in that, because I'm probably slightly too old and definitely not cool enough. But it's contextually important for these audiences. And so the reason it will become key is because if they play their cards right, they're going to enable a lot of brands to position themselves appropriately, instead of using hyper-targeting to make it seem like they're causing an uplift when they're actually having a correlation with an uplift. One thing I'd call out on one of the earlier comments around GDPR as well is that there is a pit hole that they could end up in that will be very, very costly for them, which again comes back to the joint controller versus processor. As I understand it, their role in this is that they are a processor. Now, I'm not a privacy expert, but what I understand is that capturing the data. They're then sending that to an advertiser via an API, which is then being stored in a CRM database and then being used in campaigns. Now, if you consider that then if they were to use that data somewhere within their repository to inform their targeting, all of a sudden they have become a joint controller, which basically means that they have an interest in how that data is used. So if then a regulator identifies that they've been using the data or metadata off the back of what's been captured in this lead gen, then all of a sudden we're back to square one where we were, you know, 6 to 12 months ago with these sort of hyper-targeting problems.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Definitely.
I can't wait, yeah.
And also, just as you were explaining all of that in you know, admirable detail, Nick, I think you are a bit of a privacy expert without wanting to admit it. It's you know, where is all of this being you know, sort of crafted? TikTok HQ, you know, in, I don't know, in the US or in other international head offices, to what extent do they truly understand the breadth of privacy legislation across different global markets? Because, yep, everyone's having a go at privacy legislation these days, but the devil is in the detail, and that's going to look different whether you're in Europe or whether you're in the US or whether you're in Southeast Asia, where some countries are just getting to grips with privacy, and it's not necessarily enshrined in legislation yet, but will be soon. So that's where we'll start to see things looking really interesting, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely. Shifting from privacy to competition now for our second story, the ACCC has given the 81 members of Country Press Australia interim permission to negotiate as a collective with Facebook and Google over payment for their news content. The ruling is integral to preserving news coverage, according to ACCC Chair Rod Sims, adding that the recently passed news media bargaining code was intended to allow and encourage this style of negotiation. Such collective action would naturally buck the trend of publishers forming individual deals with Facebook and Google, although the presence of these deals may in turn strengthen their hand in any negotiations with the CPA members. While acknowledging the current popularity of direct deals, Sims added, the onus now remains on Facebook and Google to continue to negotiate in good faith with news businesses of all sizes. What impact do you think the power to bargain collectively will have upon the CPA members? And also, do you predict that the ACCC will receive final approval for this? Nick, let's start off with you on that one.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is a great move. You know, I think this is one for the little guys. In Australia, it's obviously geographically much more spread out. You've got this huge country, yet the population really is kind of crammed on the East Coast next to the beaches. And so, you know, when you consider the role of these independent regional newspapers and news outlets, they're incredibly important for Australian communities, and so it is great that there's actually someone that's championing the interests for them. And I'm going to be honest, I really think if this hadn't happened, I don't see how they would have been able to survive, and that's very sad. I do think this is going to get passed, and that's because you can count on one thing, which is that, you know, when you've got companies like Google and Facebook who have the cash reserves on their balance sheets at the size that they do, everyone wants a piece of it. And if you don't believe me, just go to Yahoo Finance and just have a look at how many billions of dollars versus the debt. It's phenomenal. And really, that's what this is all about, is that they're obviously, you know, very, very profitable businesses. And so, you know, this was a very difficult process for the ACCC to get through. And the whole situation that's been playing out in Australia, I mean, we've had threats of Google's search business being withdrawn, Facebook stopped sharing news. It's been some big moves. But I think what this is showing us is that there's not a stalemate. You know, these things can move forward, but ultimately these companies are going to remain dominant. It is going to cost them in the way of probably a few $100 million collectively, I think, in Australia alone, as we have seen across many different other countries. I think for the independent news outlets around the country now, unfortunately, this is just where the hard work is going to start, because whilst they do get the power of bargaining, you know, and being able to communicate with each other and actually bargain as a collective, what they actually now need to do is start to upgrade and to change their business models. They need new leadership to really understand how to lean into these new digital partnerships. And I think that's really going to come from probably some new blood and when I say new blood, I mean that in the positive way, in that we can find within regional communities where there's an immense amount of talent. You know, luckily I've actually seen this sort of firsthand with a lot of the work that gets done in the finance sector here. So I really feel that regional communities have got so much to offer to bring in that new wave of sort of, you know, regional news operations. The only thing I would call out though is when I Googled this, I probably saw about 5 to 10 of the exact same title from all many different regional news outlets, which to me is a bad sign, and it kind of is a little bit of proof that is a valid point that actually you know, we do need them to upgrade and refresh their approach. But overall, I would expect that I think that this is a byproduct of what's happening with the major news outlets. I mean, you've only got to look at the fact that 100% of the daily newspapers published in Queensland are actually Murdoch owned. There's not enough diversity, I don't think, in media, and I feel like regional media businesses may be the means of bringing a breath of fresh air. But yeah, that would be my first call out, is please don't do the copy and paste the same headline. Let's get some of that talent. Let's get some of that fresh regional talent and show just how special some of these communities are.
That is a really interesting summary, Nick. I thought that this was, I completely agree with you. It's one for the little guys. It's one of those stories that just warms your heart really and makes you think, okay, there is, you know, someone is trying to restore balance to the world to some extent. And I've long thought that the News Media Bargaining Code and the ACCC's spearheading of it in Australia is just fantastic work. And the rest of the world are watching on very closely. And I do expect, as we see things, you know, depending on how we see things shake out over the remainder of the year, including this focus now on regional publishers and their ability perhaps to bargain collectively, I think you're going to see other countries trying to follow suit. And I don't blame them at all. It's a fantastic move. And I think that this particular story, the notion of the ACCC sort of, you know, allowing the CPA to form some kind of collective bargaining sort of organisation for the purposes of negotiations with Google and Facebook speaks volumes about how the point of this is underpinning diversity of news and journalist-provided news content in a democratic country. It's really important that you get different voices out there in the public domain. And for the ACCC to say, okay, on this occasion, we're going to say that collective bargaining is absolutely fine and it doesn't contravene any competition laws, means that this is really, really important. So I'm expecting that the CPA will get final sign-off for this, and I'll be so incredibly disappointed if it doesn't. And in fact, I'll think that it will be a good sort of, you know, I don't know, potential conspiracy theory around corruption if it doesn't get passed, because I can't think of any reason reasonable reason why it ought not to. The only opponents to this, of course, are Google and Facebook, and they're opposing it because they don't want collective bargaining. They want to be in complete control of absolutely everything when it comes down to negotiation for payment in exchange for using news in any of their, you know, in Facebook feed and in news searches, in Google searches. So I think it says it speaks volumes about the importance of the code, which is great. I also think, like you, Nick, it's a lifeline for regional news outlets. And I think you're seeing a very similar thing in other countries. In fact, on a podcast a few months ago, Lindsay and I were chatting with an agency exec who was explaining how some of their work with advertisers has been about trying to get better sort of advertising inventory across smaller regional publishers in the UK because they're trying to reach different audiences. And that's phenomenally important. So I think, again, this is underscoring the importance of regional news, but from the point of view of diversity, right? And giving those businesses an opportunity to survive. I completely agree with you as well that what we don't want to see, therefore, is a couple of dominant news media outlets sort of owning all of the regional publications and controlling the content that goes on in within those publications. Unfortunately, I think Australia for a long time has had a less diverse media landscape to some extent with Murdoch and Fairfax owned properties, and it would be great to see more diversity in Australia. That's why it's been, you know, I'm not surprised at all that The Guardian Australia has been phenomenally successful and a really important additional national news source. So let's start to see, like you say, Nick, perhaps, some increased enthusiasm within those regional media organisations to start generating more local news, to get more control over how that news is given airtime, and let's see that grow the diversity of the voices within news media. The other thing is, you know, nod to your very salient point, Nick, about population demographics in Australia. Not only is it about sort of reaching those vast populations, but it's that I think a lot of those rural populations in Australia often feel very underrepresented in popular culture, in media, in politics. It's a very, very, big issue in Australia, the idea that the majority of the population is clustered around the southeast coastal areas, and in general, the majority of the population in Australia is in big capital cities, just means that rural community is even more cut off, and so they need representation and voices, and this is hopefully a way to bring that forward. And yeah, more power to them. And I mean, Rod Sims, he's like a bit of a hero, really, if you ask me, because whatever Google and Facebook come out with, he just comes straight back with a great kind of competition line. And, you know, one of his lines in an earlier a conversation about all of this back in January before the bargaining code was fully passed, and also before Google performed their experiment of cutting off news in search in Australia to Australian residents. I think his point was, you know, Google and Facebook keep arguing that this should all be handled within a commercial negotiation and a commercial deal. And he said, it's not commercial if one person has all the power. And this collective bargaining for small regional publishers gives them some power. And that's exactly what should be happening.
Kind of echo your points around the ACCC. I think, you know, they should be seen as a shining example to all regulators. Because obviously the news media bargaining code, it didn't go quite as full through to fruition as they'd have hoped, but they've come back strongly and have gone, right, we will, you know, fight for publishers' rights. Whereas a lot of regulators, I think they would get that kind of one feet and then go, okay, we'll leave that on the back burner and focus on something else. I think on your point, Rachel, where, you know, Google have kind of, they've been arrogant for far too long. And I think, we discussed on the podcast, I think around the start of March, when Google basically said, no, publishers don't want to negotiate collectively. You should not have the right to be able to say that, because you're in no position to be able to. It's like me saying, everyone at Google really likes eggs. They may do, but at the same time, it's probably not true. And I'm in no position to say that.
Exactly. So it's just you are not the arbiter of egg fancifulness.
Exactly. So it's just, I think anything that can kind of take Google back down a peg and make them realize that, no, you are not this all-powerful, all-strong body, and you actually do have to consider the rights of other participants within the market.
Yeah, and I think there's probably two really important words here that I picked up on when you introduced this one, Matt, which is good faith. And so what I really hope the Australian government continues to do is to provide ongoing fund to actually support, which I believe they have started off doing, because this will need enforcing, because all it will take is for a few discussions between some very high-paid lawyers to blur the boundaries of what is good faith. And I hope that's not the direction that this goes in. And, you know, I'm a big Google fan, particularly their tech, and, you know, I've sort of made a career of working with a lot of their technologies. I would also hope that this is more about their interplay and probably about defending those cash reserves locally from a lot of these major news empires. But yeah, I just really do hope that good faith does continue.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yep. More power to the Aussies.
So shifting tack back onto first-party data now, BuzzFeed has launched a suite of data services to eliminate third-party data blind spots once the cookie disappears. Named Lighthouse and released in March, the solution gives brands access to BuzzFeed's first-party data on their 104 million monthly users. Born of the need to find a way to sustain ad revenue in a world without third-party cookies, Lighthouse has helped drive more than half the publishers' 2021 ad buys, according to BuzzFeed. Unlike BuzzFeed, though, many publishers remain unprepared for first-party data-dependent landscape. According to a Forrester survey, for example, only 50% of publishers have started developing a plan to monetize their first-party data, with only 28% having actually implemented a strategy to do so. Growing consumer distrust towards advertisers is a significant problem in itself, but it also highlights the growing importance of cultivating first-party data, write Adweek's Mark Stenberg and Ronan Shields in an article published late last month. CPG brands which recognize that fact have launched new DTC e-commerce capabilities or brand engagement platforms to make up for this deficit in their first-party data sources. So my first question to you guys is first-party data the new oil for ad tech? And are there any viable alternatives to having and using it? Or are they just simply not up to scratch at this point? Rachel, let's start off with you.
So first-party data is definitely critical to the entire advertising ecosystem these days, more than ever before. I think in answer to the second part of your question, there probably are still some alternatives. The viability of them, though, I think is very short-term, right? So my point of view here, and it's a little connected to what we were just talking about with smaller regional publishers in Australia, is that I think it's important for all publishers to be building out some form of first-party data infrastructure. So, you know, of course, the common mechanism here is getting readers and users logins, and that might not be practical for some smaller publications. But the time has come when all publishers need to be thinking about ways in which to do that. They have to come up with a diversified monetization model, and you know, one of the sort of hooks for that monetization, for the diversity element of those monetization models, has got to be using, gathering and building out first-party data infrastructure and architecture. I'm not surprised to hear that, you know, there's still a big proportion of publishers that aren't ready for this or haven't been able to work on those capabilities. There'll be many reasons for that. There'll be, you know, publishers are dealing with a lot of challenges, and, you know, it's not something that's been that straightforward, especially for smaller publishers. For larger publishers, it's something that's been a little bit easier. But I think what BuzzFeed have done here with Lighthouse is really interesting, because they are obviously finding a way to sort of offer the value that they're gathering through their first-party data infrastructure directly back to advertisers and marketers, buyers of advertising. And I think we're going to start seeing this more commonly with other publishers, with either other publishers directly or publisher collectives, where they've some way of building what I'm sort of referring to myself informally as publisher cohorts. And I think this kind of links a little bit with conversations about how both brands and advertisers and publishers are preparing themselves for a disappearance of third-party cookie targeting and tracking, right? Which is that you need to be in a position where you can identify audiences to reach if you're a publisher, and audiences to offer inventory against and targeting solutions for if you're a publisher. Sorry, did I say that the right way around? To reach if you're a brand, a buyer, and to target if you, and to offer up as targeting opportunities if you're a publisher. And so it seems to me that the more first party data that a publisher's got, the more they can roll that into some kind of a platform and create some sort of a cohort of users and do deals more directly with advertisers or develop more of a direct relationship with advertisers and marketers, the better off they will be. So I think this is a brilliant move from BuzzFeed, who, let's not forget, is a publisher that's experienced significant challenges in the last couple of years, and they reduced their headcount very significantly at the end of 2019 and then the beginning of 2020. So, you know, this is a good move on their behalf. It'll be really interesting to see what value they get out of it. I think there's one other thing that I wanted to add to this as well, which is that I think for brands, this notion of publishers having more of a direct relationship with them will become more and more compelling the more and more granular that or usable that data becomes. And so slightly sort of a different track but connected is the notion of big CPG brands, for example, perhaps moving some of their in-store marketing budget into a commerce media budget, and in an environment where they know where they can get some value from that transaction. They not only do they know where that budget's going, but they're perhaps getting some visibility into the data that's being used for targeting for those budgets. Then I think the more they'll be drawn into working more and more closely and more directly with publishers. That's maybe not a like-for-like example with what BuzzFeed are doing here, but I was thinking of the likes of big marketplaces, your eBays of the world or your other e-com marketplaces that are looking to try to get those commerce media budgets from CPG brands who are, you know, very first party data bereft in any other environment.
Absolutely. In terms of the sort of first party data point on the CPG brands, I think with coronavirus, it's sort of accelerated the trend of digital transformation, and therefore brands are increasingly realizing the importance of having that first party data. I think what should now be the focus, particularly for third-party ad tech, is activating that data and helping the brands and the publishers sort of work with that data. Nick, interested to get your thoughts on this one in terms of that, and whether there are sort of the viable alternatives, if any, for having that first-party data.
Yeah, well, I think, as Rachel said, we're seeing so many things play out on the privacy landscape, whether it's IDFA or third-party cookies, that, you know, anyone, especially with the credentials of BuzzFeed, who is you know, launching something like this and really advocating for it, I think it's only a good thing. In my perspective, anyone who can sort of shift from explicit targeting and hyper-targeting towards contextual, and also who has that focus on building first-party data sets and forming partnerships, I think is a winning formula is in this environment. I'm going to have to say the approach is great, but I am a bit of a skeptic when it comes to the execution, though. And the reason for that is, who owns this data? Is it first party? Is it second party? Is it third party? I'll give you an example, right? Some of the organizations, I'm sure it's the same in the UK. Forgive me, it's been a little while since I've been over to the UK, but over here, the airlines are really, really good. Qantas is very, very good. You know, Virgin, the list goes on, the supermarkets as well. They're excellent at activating their data. Not only do they govern it very well, but they work with partners. They have even invested in businesses that are aggregating these huge data sets, ranging from sort of household panel data right through to their own sales or their credit bureau data. And the way that they're able to then partner up with other companies and cross-pollinate their first-party data sets is absolutely incredible. Now, I would refer to that largely as second-party data. That's not necessarily first-party data, because first-party data would indicate that you have an ownership of that. Of course, if you're the airline, it's your first-party data. But if you're engaging someone or a commercial partner in the way that BuzzFeed is engaging their clients, I would argue that they're not actually building a first-party data set for them. Now, I can, of course, be corrected on that, but I'm just going on what this is being presented at face value. So all the caveats come with that. I haven't seen all the technical documentation, but if this is going to be activated directly in a publisher environment, I would argue at best that will be second-party data, or if it's then extended into other partner environments, then it becomes a use of third-party data. And that's not to say that it's necessarily going to be using things like cookies or, you know, any of the redundant technology. But what it does mean is, again, we come back to these new privacy standards that GDPR has set. You know, as I mentioned earlier, what's the role that BuzzFeed plays in this? If they're going to go and activate client A's data over here in these properties, who owns that? Are they a joint controller in that? If someone, you know, be it a customer or just general public, wants their data deleted, who's responsible for that? And I don't just say this to be pedantic. I mean, companies can get fined at large and, you know, big chunks of their turnover for not getting this right. And so I would sort of issue caution there around, first of all, the ownership. Second of all, the integrations and the technical integrations, and to make sure that if those roles are defined, that there's a very clear path to be able to control where that data goes. Because, I mean, do we know any companies who haven't had their data at some point? You know, it can be a very costly mistake. And the other thing is, I would say, is activation. How will you actually physically activate that data? Is it only in a publisher environment? Is it potentially through a use of a partner network within BuzzFeed? Is it just their properties? I think there's a lot more that we need to understand before really making a decision on whether this is a big opportunity, or whether potentially the work involved in making this work is worth it. Now, I'm an advocate for them. I think they have some tremendous capabilities and a great brand, great content. You know, there's so much complexity in so many advertiser environments at the moment. You know, we're talking, you've got technology teams who are building all of these MarTech stacks who have been faced with the biggest pandemic of our lifetimes and have had to migrate everyone to working from home. And then they've got this backlog of all this other MarTech stuff. So, you know, how are you going to go and explain to them that, yeah, actually, we need more resources for you to come and scope this out, go on the journey with us? For me, you know, Google really does have a bit of a competitive advantage here, which is their third in the cloud race. And a lot of companies are now embracing a hybrid cloud environment. So they're working with AWS, they're working with Google, they're you know, AWS may be for their front end of their website, they may have Microsoft for their enterprise and their sort of customer data, they may have something like Snowflake and many other different cloud environments. And so you got to ask the question, are they ready to go and integrate with someone who may not actually be like a huge part of the media spend on a lot of media plans at the moment? It would definitely be worth, weighing that up. But also, you know what? I could be wrong, and it could be that they've really thought this through, and it's just a case of educating the average marketer on exactly what that first party data means and how it's activated. If you ask me, any company that can help you with either retargeting effectively or suppressing any of your media that doesn't need to be served to people who may have already bought from you, it's irrelevant to, then they're going to do 80% of the work that those third-party cookies were doing, and those the easy integrations that we've been used to. So I take my hat off to them, but my clear watch out would be great intent, absolutely love the approach, be very careful with the execution.
You raise a really good point in terms of there just needs to be that greater clarification in terms of from the regulators in terms of GDPR, because obviously, you know, that's been in effect, what, the last sort of two, three years now. And yet there still hasn't quite, there's still the unanswered questions there. And I think anything that can be done to clarify these new solutions that are cropping up, which can be, you know, obviously, like you say, they do have the potential to be a really good thing for the industry. They just need clarifying on to make sure everyone's sort of going down the right road as such.
Yeah, and I think that's really probably got to be aimed at the chief risk officers and the heads of privacy within these companies, because they're ultimately the ones who will probably sign off on this at the end of the day.
But I also think this raises a really interesting point in general, right, which is that if, for example, and I don't want to necessarily disappear down a Google third-party cookie rabbit hole here, but if you look at Google's flock proposition, many people in the industry would argue that the notion of developing some sort of user cohorts is a good idea. Whether it ought to be in the hands of Google or not is another matter, because their argument, of course, in putting forward Flock as a solution, as a replacement solution for third-party cookies, is that they are, you know, this is them sort of pooling together users on the basis of first-party data and first-party information. You could argue that actually that's not really a first-party relationship either. Just because you're moving through a browser doesn't necessarily mean that you have given explicit permission for your data to be used in the production of developing a cohort. And so I suppose when I mention the word publisher cohort, I'm thinking of them doing a similar thing to what Flock is proposing, except that the publisher is doing it within their own assets, within their own community. And in fact, in that example, I think of them more as a more legitimate first-party data owner than I do when I think about Google building their flock cohorts. But, you know, that's a whole other debate. I'm sure you've got an opinion on that, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, again, I know I sound like a bit of a broken record. I totally get where you're coming from. And I would probably have a bit of a balanced view, which is to say, what is it that my, you know, chief risk officer or head of privacy is going to say about it? Because I have actually been privy to some conversations where the main concern about the use of some platforms is how is the metadata being used to inform, you know, downstream interactions with certain people. So you're absolutely right. Just because it's not at a user ID level doesn't mean the data isn't being used to inform how, you know, people are being targeted. So it's more of like an indirect use of it. And I think probably I'd expect Google to be, I think they're probably going to have further regulatory attention as we see the 2022 deadline get closer. Because you're right, you don't have to have that sort of one-to-one targeting for it to be a personal use of your data.
Awesome. Shifting into the second part of our podcast, basically focusing, Nick, on what you're working on in all the sort of backwinds of identity, IDFA, privacy, data, everything we've been discussing today. So over to you and what have you been working on?
Excellent. Oh, well, I love nerding out over a range of different sort of data, digital and tech initiatives on, you know, on a daily basis. I'm very lucky that I get to play with everything from, sort of digital marketing and marketing measurement right through to things like advanced analytics and machine learning models. So I absolutely love the work that I do, but there's a special place in my heart for everything that's happening at the moment with this identity piece. And so a lot of my time really, I would say, is going into explaining this to the marketers in Australia. And there are some very, very talented people here. And I think over the past few years have particularly become very, very capable at building brands. At the same time as, activating sales using these new and emerging forms of what you call digital marketing, but it's just platforms that are using digital technology. I don't like the term digital marketing. And so for me, that job that is on my to-do list at the moment is really helping to educate people on the so what, you know. Who cares if all these technological changes are happening in the background? Who cares if company A or company B is getting fined for this or in the news about this? What does it actually mean to marketers? And I've distilled that down into five key points. And that is to basically say that the more that the data that we've been using for the last 5 to 10 years for a number of different digital and marketing activities, or even just some of our like proprietary channels, whether it's email or live chat, a lot of these activities are now subject to performance hits. Basically, marketing is going to get less effective in the channels that are using them. And the reason is, number one, targeting prospects and retargeting people who have been to your website is going to get harder, because without knowing that person 123 is browser 1756, it gets harder and harder to actually be able to serve that specific information and to know who you're targeting is the potential customer that you do want. The second one is personalization. So the example would be, I want to serve ad sports fans. You know, in the old days of using third-party data, I'd look for cookie pulls where maybe they've purchased a sports ticket on a ticketing website, and that transaction data has been stored and it's in my third-party network. Now, I'm going to need to look for people who've been on sports sites and then potentially start to actually retrofit the content in my campaigns so that it's a bit more appealing and it's contextually relevant to what they're looking at and what they're doing, as opposed to being explicit. You know, it's like moving from explicit to implicit. Next one is, of course, analytics, the measurement models and how you attribute sales is, of course, without cookies, it's basically going to lose a large amount of the data and the reports that we're used to using. And I think everyone is probably now starting to realize that those companies that built media mix models to really measure the incremental impact of the spend that they're investing and then to optimize the spend using those models, they're the ones who have probably done a lot better and had a longer term focus, as opposed to the sort of short term sales bursts and focusing on things like CPAs, cost per acquisitions or cost per clicks, compliance and regulation. That's another one. I mean, you know, not just making people aware of the fact that you can be open to regulatory action. I mean, just look at where emails were 10 to 20 years ago. That's probably where this is going definitely in the short to medium term, that actually I think we're going to start to see more and more companies get fined for their misuse of data in third-party advertising channels. But also, look at something like IDFA. If you're not compliant with Apple's terms, then potentially you can actually risk being delisted from the App Store. And there's more and more of platforms that are going this way. These precedents that have been set globally by the likes of Apple and you know, the regulators. It's how everything is going to go. So there was something else. There was one more point, but you know what? I'll keep that a mystery. You have to go to my website to find it.
Brilliant.
But the yeah, really for me, it's about the so what. And that so what is, if you really care about the performance of your campaigns and you truly want to make a difference to the growth of your business, then you need to understand some of these changes that are happening worldwide in some of the most common platforms that your customers are using and in those environments where you'll find your customers. And actually, sometimes the solutions can be very, very simple and it's not all doom and gloom.
That's amazing, Nick, because it's the sort of thing that we kind of ponder on almost on a daily basis at Exchange Worries. You know, who's having these conversations either within brands or directly with marketing professionals? To what extent do brands feel sort of aware of exactly what's happening? And to what extent do individual professionals care? You know, depending, I suppose, on, I know they care, you know, about doing their jobs well, but to what extent do they feel close enough to some of the more technical detail behind the changes that are undergoing at the moment in the industry? To what extent do they feel kind of connected to those and close to those, and like those are actually having an impact on their day-to-day jobs? So you've got some insight on that.
Yeah, I think we've definitely seen that this has become one of the top concerns here in Australia. And so there's definitely, as I say, there's such a great level of talent. I really do think globally there's an exceptional level of talent here. And so there has been a great response. I think the trick with this is it's like if you've got a problem with your car, right? You might be willing to go and check your tires and, probably wash the windscreen here and go and get it clean. But when it comes to looking under the hood, there's probably very few people that really want to get under there and change the oil. A lot of the time it's better just to basically take it to an expert. And I think that's never a bad thing, is to ask for help. And so, you know, given that this is very technical at the heart of it, I'd say the best thing that marketers really can do is focus on what it means and to really make it clear why they're taking action to solve this and to see it as a new start. I always think with change, you know, think about something like the whole contextual targeting piece. I mean, you get to move away from like serving a bunch of ads to people and pretending that they bought because of it, to actually running these like really engaging, contextually relevant ads and probably focusing a bit more on brand. But I think what's at the heart of it for me, I'm going to be a bit of a sort of shameless finance guy here and say, if you had to sit in front of those hardworking people who have actually invested their capital in you, you know, assuming that you're a publicly listed company, and if not, maybe the private financiers, if you had to sit in front of those shareholders and justify the spend of their hard-earned money, what would you tell them when they ask, you know, what are you doing to protect our money and the expenditure that you're going to put into marketing? You know, what are you going to do about that? We know this is a problem. It's no longer just sort of conspiracy theorists. We can see this all playing out. I think that's the level of urgency that we probably need, is that, too often we can kind of sit behind these marketing attribution reports and try and find ways to justify it. I think it really comes back to the guiding principle. Are you doing the right thing by your shareholders and your customers? Yeah. And that's never a bad way to go, I think. And first thing is really just reaching out and getting help from experts.
And sorry, Matt, I keep butting in here. Another question about just going back to measurements again, because you noted that in your one of four or five key things that you're chatting with brands and marketers about. What's your opinion on where we're going with measurements in a post-cook environment? What's going to be the measurement solution, according to Nick.
According to me, it's, you can find it for a one-off price on my website. I think where it's going, I mean, it goes without saying, you know, particularly in my time over the last year, the last couple of years, I've leaned more towards data science. And the reason that that is, bearing in mind, I started my career like selling kitchens over the phone, right? So I've been on a bit of a journey, but where it's led me is to really understand that whether you have artificial intelligence, you know, optimizing things, whether you've got the best technology, the best platform, you might even have the most money, where you will be the most competitive is where you're analytically curious and where you really understand what the data is telling you and where you have a scientific approach to analyzing data. And so what I'd say with that is you can't build good measurement models until you do really, really thorough and great analysis on and get the right data, get it in the clean, most tidy, regular and compliant fashion, and to understand the nature of it and ensure that you're not setting yourself up to measure incorrectly or take false positives or false negatives. That said, so there's almost like my massive preamble of waffle to basically say you will always need good talent when it comes to measurement. There is no way right now, if anyone tells you that, you know, the sentient nature of artificial intelligence can come in and replace human curiosity, send them my way, because I think that's utter BS. And I think humans will continue to play a very, very significant role in that for a while. But I think probably the most common solution right now is going to be media mix modeling. And the difference between media mix modeling and, say, something like last touch attribution, or, you know, could be Google Analytics, it could be an ad server, Adobe Analytics, they will typically look at things like impressions and clicks. And then you will attribute those clicks or conversions, shouldn't forget conversions. You'll then attribute those back to activities, and you've got different ways of doing it. It could be, you know, you might use something like game theory or a Shapley model or last touch, first touch, many different ways. But you'll then attribute credits back to those channels or those activities. Whereas something like media mix modeling is looking for the incremental uplifts and the relationships between different activities, whether it's media spend, whether it's even just, you know, things like branch closures or the negative impact of might be bad PR, or it could be things like, you know, customer service issues or seasonality. And it will allow you to use statistical models to see what the values are and then output. First of all, you can then actually test your model and achieve the most optimal performance, so that, i.e., the predictions it spat out have had a high level of accuracy. And then you use it to look at scenarios to basically say, here's what we want to spend and here's what we want to do to get the optimal sales output. It's not a standalone solution, so we will see the analytics data will be used with it. And if we're talking a sort of best in class, you'll also be using things like customer research to validate it, plus things like split testing and control groups to also validate the assumptions and the conclusions that you're taking from that model. So it's like media mix modeling will rise, but it's going to be used in tandem with click reporting and split testing and customer research.
Amazing. The future of marketing, according to Nick Barnett. I love it.
Awesome. Well, one question I had for you, Nick, is in terms of, obviously, you've got, you know, a great in-depth knowledge of the Australian market. What would you say is something that the market is doing particularly well compared to, say, on like a regional or global basis? And what can participants learn from what's happening within the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. Do you know what? I'm going to shout out again. They had a hard year to the travel and tourism sector here. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at the economy, obviously it's a remote sort of isolated country, very far away from everything. It's also geographically very sparse. So, you know, there's obviously a relationship with China and parts of Asia that obviously is very, very important to the economy and our continued GDP growth. So when you consider that, tourism and education as well, I'm going to shout out to them. They have done a phenomenal job it's a key part of the economy. And I think what they've done to promote the brand internationally and regionally as well. Look at how they pivoted into the quarantines and the travel bans. They have been able to really stimulate this interstate tourism exceptionally well. And I have no doubt, looking at how the country's actually recovered from the pandemic and managed the control of the spread here, and we haven't even, you know, fully opened up the borders yet. I think they've done an exceptional job, and also, you know, universities and then the private education sector really getting back to work. So I really do take my hat off to them, and I think I really hope that they continue to sort of recover. And I think if probably to your earlier question earlier on about you know what the sense of immediacy is here, think about the amount of debt that some of the universities and particularly the travel companies have taken on. I really hope marketers become a core part of growing and becoming more competitive and bringing their debt levels down and their cash back up, because at the end of the day, that's what puts marketers in the job.
That's a really interesting perspective, Nick, because they're two industries that you've called out that are so significantly important to the Australian economy, which might be not as well understood in other countries. You know, international students to Australian universities really drive that industry forward. And of course, that's been completely precluded for all Australian universities pretty much throughout 2020 because of border closures. Yeah. And they've been desperately, the university sector as well has been desperately trying to work out ways to set up some kind of reasonable quarantine scheme that could passport international students back into Australia. But as far as I understand it, that's still, you know, that hasn't been set up and settled as yet. You know, it's probably something they're looking to in the future to get set up for next year and beyond. But I mean, you know, we mustn't forget, we all have a bit of a chat when there isn't anyone either living in Australia or another Australian on the call with us about how Australia hasn't really had a pandemic in comparison to everyone else in the world. What I mean by that is you've very fortunately not suffered huge infection rates and debt and high numbers of deaths, which is amazing and fabulous. That doesn't mean to say that the economy wasn't massively impacted by the pandemic in the same way that everybody else's economy wasn't. But that those are two things that are a real feature, right? Closure to international students and closure to international travel meant that those two industries in Australia had to completely rethink the way that they were doing things. So it's fascinating to hear you calling them out as examples of people and brands and marketers, if you like, that have managed to, you know, sort of restructure their focus and to get that and to still keep those businesses ticking and rolling over in a domestic economy fashion, and then how they move to, you know, reaching out to their international market again once borders open, whenever that will be, sometime soon, I hope.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, that just about takes us out of time. Nick, thank you ever so much for joining us. It's been a really interesting discussion.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Honestly, I think you guys are awesome, and I really appreciate you, taking the time to listen to me waffle on.
We love a good waffling here at Exchange Wire.
Exactly. Poor Matt, he's going to have to do some editing of my waffle. Never mind. Yours wasn't waffle. Mine was waffle.
Not at all. That was awesome.
No, it'll be a pleasure to re-listen to this one. Rachel, thanks to you ever so much for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Awesome. And thanks to you all ever so much for listening. Take care.